I am Easton Moore. Today I'm going to be interviewing Gary Moore. He's my father. Today is March 14th, 2019, and we are in my bedroom away from my family. It's just me and him right now.
My name is Gary Moore. I was born February 29th, 1952 in Bradford, Pennsylvania. My parents are Gail and Kay Moore. And Bradford's a little bitty town just south of the New York state line in northwestern Pennsylvania. I lived there the first 7 years of my life. Went to Sixth Ward Elementary School in kindergarten and first grade. And then we moved to Broken Arrow, Oklahoma for my dad's job.
What was it like in Bradford, Pennsylvania? Was it diverse living there?
No, not really. It was mostly white, middle class. There was a Kendall Oil refinery there. It was one of the major industries. This is in the Pennsylvania oil fields, right in the middle of that. So my grandfather worked in the oil business. My dad worked in the oil business.
Did you have any prospects of furthering that family line of working in the oil business at the time, or did you want to do something different with your life?
Well, since I was just a little bitty kid, and we moved to Oklahoma when I was seven, at that point, never knew what I wanted to be. I do know that I loved baseball. I wanted to be a baseball player. I never had any ambitions other than just going out and playing with my best friend.
Whenever you moved to Oklahoma, what was life like there? Was it more diverse?
No, it wasn't. Broken Arrow is a little tiny town. We moved there in August 1959. There was exactly one black family who lived there, and they went to school in the Catholic grade school that I went to. Their kids did. And that was, to me, that was no big deal. It was just another kid in a Catholic school having to put up with the nuns.
Was there any large signs of segregation in Broken Arrow, like with that one family, or were things fairly desegregated there?
Everything, well, when the family moved into the area and started going to the Catholic Church, a bunch of the parishioners met with the pastor, Father Robert Dombrowski, and said that they would quit if he let them go to church there and let their children go to the Catholic school there. Father Dombrowski was a very interesting man. He is Polish. He was in Nazi concentration camps during World War II, and he told the parishioners, said, fine, you don't want this, you can leave, but these people are welcome in my church, and their children are welcome in our school. And that's the only thing that I heard about that. I don't remember any families quitting the church. I don't remember any families pulling their kids out of the Catholic school. They just listened to Father Robert and said, okay, we'll try this out.
What was your family's views on segregation? Did they approve of this black family, or were they against it?
I have no idea about my dad. He wasn't Catholic. He never went to church. He didn't have any kind of, he didn't have any say one way or the other. My mother was one of the leaders of the people who wanted to leave that church and wanted to pull me and my brother out of the school. But my mother was a very racist person. In Broken Arrow, there were a lot of indigenous people, mostly Choctaw Indians. That was the Choctaw. Broken Arrow is kind of right in the middle of the Choctaw Nation. And my mother, when she went back to work, worked for the county highway department as their office manager. And there were a lot of Choctaw people who worked there, and she called them filthy Indians. And but that was my mother. I didn't listen to her. My brother didn't listen to her. She had these really racist, bizarre ideas, and Dad just kind of blew her off and let her rant and rave. And he didn't say anything about it.
Did you not listen to her very well? You and your brother, did you two not listen to her well because of what you said, those crazy ravings? Or was it more of the female position in society at the time and how like males were dominant? Was that, did that play a factor into it at all?
No, it didn't. My mother was also an alcoholic. She drank a lot. And she was also diagnosed with a bipolar mental illness. So she was supposed to take medications. When she got depressed, she got angry. When she was in her manic phases, she was kind of the life of the party and would... and literally have parties and just do things like completely change the house around or help a friend wallpaper their house or paint their house. And Dad, again, he just kind of said, well, that's your mom. But remember, she's your mother.
Other than your mother, would you say that your family was fairly progressive for the time?
Productive how?
Progressive.
Progressive.
As in more liberal at the time to other political thoughts?
No. Both my parents were registered Republicans. They both, every election, voted straight Republican ticket. I'm old enough that I didn't, kids didn't get the vote until I was 20 years old. That's when they changed the voting age from 21 to 18. And the first time I voted, it was in the 1972 presidential elections between Nixon and McGovern. And my dad, I was at the University of Oklahoma then, and I came back to Broken Arrow to cast my vote. And a week later, the Broken Arrow Ledger, which at the time was a weekly newspaper, posted the election results precinct by precinct. And in the precinct that my parents and I voted in, there was one vote for McGovern. My dad circled that. He sent me a copy of the paper. He circled that one vote and in the margins wrote, "Gee, I wonder who this vote was."
What was your family's opinion on the Civil Rights Acts and movements in the 60s?
My dad didn't have an opinion, or at least if he did, he didn't mention it in front of me or my brother. My mother would rant and rave about those blacks. And when Martin Luther King was assassinated, actually, about 2 weeks before Martin Luther King was assassinated, one of my mother's good friends, I overheard my mother talking to her, and this friend said, I just hope someone gets that guy. Talking about Martin Luther King. And 2 weeks later, when he was assassinated, that friend was shocked and horrified. But my mother, she didn't say anything about it. She was quiet for a few days and then went on about her life.
At the time, you were probably about in your early teens. Did you have much of an opinion on the civil rights movement, or were you too young to develop that those sorts of thoughts?
Martin Luther King was assassinated in April 1968. I was 16 at the time, and yeah, my feelings about race then did not reflect those of my parents. I was 68, was in the middle of the youth movement, the hippies, and I was becoming more and more liberal and against racial discrimination and against the Vietnam War specifically. It was a time that I felt I was formulating my own thoughts and opinions and starting to speak out and speak up to my parents. In fact, when I had to register to for the draft, I said I didn't want to. I said, I'm not going to register for the draft. And my mother said, you think you're better than your father? You think you're too good to go and fight for your country? And I looked at her and said, gee, I didn't know we were Vietnamese. And then she slapped me. I did go ahead and register. And that was around the time that the federal government got rid of the student deferments and started doing the lottery. And they were that year that my draft number came up in the lottery. They were polling boys whose lottery numbers were 1 through 250. My lottery number was 305, so I did not have to be drafted.
Your father was a veteran from World War II, and he served in Italy, right?
Yes.
What were his views on you sort of defying the draft? Because your mother was strictly against it, but was your father more neutral, like what showed before with his other views, or was he more outward with this?
He was neutral. He didn't express his opinions. He felt that I was old enough to make decisions for myself. He had when he was in Italy, the first jobs that he had when he was there, he got there about 3 weeks before VE Day. And so Italy was mostly in Allied control, but there were still a few partisan snipers about. And his first job there was escorting supply lines from the port of Naples to various army bases around Italy. And I remember seeing a letter that he wrote back to my mother from that time. And he said that one of the boys in his company got killed by a sniper a couple of days before his platoon went out on a convoy. Shortly after that, he was transferred to Stars and Stripes. And so he was pulled out of the kind of the sweep up, and he was a driver and drove Stars and Stripes reporters around various places in Italy.
Your father respected your beliefs on whether to participate in the Vietnam War or not, but what were his views? Was he more pro-war or anti-war?
He never expressly stated to me what his views were, but I always thought that he was more anti-war when he told my mother that I was old enough to make my own decisions and to leave me alone about this.
Didn't he have a sticker on one of his suitcases that said, "Support the war effort, run over a protester"?
Actually, it said, "Support the war effort, run over a hippie." And both me and my brother grew up to be kind of hippie-ish. We both had long hair. We both had scraggly beards. We both were kind of hippie musicians, too. And Dad, he liked the fact that we were musicians and were playing music. He didn't like how we dressed or some of the things that we said or felt about the world in general. But he let us have our own opinions, and he let us be who we were.
Taking a step back, when did you start getting largely interested in music? Because you were a music major at the University of Oklahoma.
Yes.
So when did you really start taking interest in music? Like, this is something I really like, or like something I'd really want to do with my life?
Well, when I was 8 years old, my mother made me take accordion lessons, and we had to drive into Tulsa once a week for accordion lessons, and they rented an accordion for me from the local music store, and I hated every minute of it. I couldn't play the damn thing. I just didn't want to have anything to do with it. The only reason I really went to those accordion lessons is it was right next door to Bunny Bread Bakery, and you could smell the bread baking at night when you're going into the studio and out of the studio. But I got interested in music when I heard that my dad was a trombone player in high school, and so I wanted to play trombone. And so in the sixth grade band, I started with trombone and played trombone in the school bands in junior high and high school. And when I was in junior high, I wanted to start playing guitar, and so my dad bought me a bass guitar and an amp, and I taught myself with the help of the Carol K bass method. Taught myself how to play the bass, and starting in the junior high jazz band and going on to the high school jazz band, I played electric bass. And I got good enough at it that, and my brother started playing drums when he started sixth grade, and he bought his own drum set when he was in eighth grade and taking drum lessons. And we were in a kind of garage band together with a couple of my friends from school. I was the bass player, he was the drummer, and we used to fight a lot. I used to yell at him, "You're rushing the beat." And he used to yell back at me, "No, you're dragging the beat." but we had a lot of fun. And we both played in various bands throughout junior high and high school, and I went off to college, and for 2 years I did nothing in music. I was a quote psychology major unquote, but then I started to think about music more and more and more and wanting to do more with it, so I switched to be a music major again, started playing in trombone, but then I took electric bass lessons from the bass teacher at OU, John Williams. He played in the Oklahoma City Symphony. And after a semester of electric bass lessons, I switched to the upright bass and started taking lessons from him, and was in the University of Oklahoma Orchestra on bass. I played in the Lawton Symphony Orchestra. I played in a lot of little community orchestras around Lawton, Oklahoma, Hamilton, Ohio, Middletown, Ohio. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. I love music. I can't imagine my life without it.
Were there any music groups, such as like bands or anything like that, that started turning your interest towards being a hippie? Or did your thoughts of being a hippie come from other sources?
I guess in 1967, it was called the Summer of Love, and there were kids from all over the country going out to San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. And it was all over the news all the time about these young people doing their thing. And they would sometimes feature some of the bands out there like the Grateful Dead or Jefferson Airplane. And particularly for me, it was Jefferson Airplane that started it for me. I loved Grace Slick's voice, and they were the music that they did was kind of ethereal rock and roll, and they talked about unusual subjects, at least unusual by my reckoning. They talked about taking drugs and pills in the song White Rabbit. One pill makes you stronger, another, or taller, another makes you small. And the one that mother gives you doesn't do anything at all. Go ask Alice. That was some of the lines from that. It was a very interesting, very fun time.
But, yeah, continue.
Yeah. But, yeah, and the Grateful Dead, again, they were in singing and playing this kind of, I don't want to say drug-induced, but drug-related music. But those were the two that scene and that era, those were the two bands that I remember most about and most fondly of.
Did you go to this event in San Francisco, or did you listen to it on the radio or watch it on TV?
It was all TV related for me. 1967, I was what, 15, and living in a small town in Oklahoma. Of course I wanted to get out and go to that, but there was absolutely no way, being raised as a straight-up Catholic boy, that I would do that, be that out with my parents. But it was that, and later on when Woodstock came about, I thought of every way possible that I could go to Woodstock, and just could not make it happen.
Did you end up going to many concerts later on when you were able to? Like, you said you weren't able to go to Woodstock, but were you able to go to other rock concerts?
Not till I got into college. And then the first concert I went to at the University of Oklahoma was Jimi Hendrix. And he played in the old University of Oklahoma basketball gym, basketball arena. And this was shortly before he died, actually. But I went to see Jimi Hendrix. Later on in the mid-70s, we started hearing about Armadillo World headquarters down in Austin, Texas. And I took a road trip with some of my friends down to Austin to hear Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention and Maria Muldaur, who is this Louisiana country pop singer opening for Frank Zappa. I also went to more traditional concerts like Simon and Garfunkel, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. But it wasn't until I got to college that I felt comfortable enough to break out and go to these things.
Would you say that you went to concerts regularly, or was it a very rare thing during college?
It was a rare thing during college. I mean, the concerts themselves didn't cost much money, and at that time, school didn't cost that much money. I was only paying $13 a credit hour going to school. Inpatient. And it was $150 a semester for the dorms. But still, no one had any money. I mean, concerts were, I think the most I ever paid for a concert at that time was Jimi Hendrix, and it cost me $5 to get in. No one had any money. And the concerts themselves that I went to were on the rare side, because I didn't have much of an opportunity to go with schoolwork and driving back and forth between Norman and Broken Arrow a lot.
Due to your lack of ability to attend many concerts and other musical events, did you try tuning in more often through TV and radio like you had previously with the San Francisco event?
Oh, yeah. That and records. There were used record stores all over Norman, and we could go in and buy 10 albums for a dollar. At used stores. Sometimes they were all scratched up and you could barely hear the music, but a lot of times it was almost a pristine new vinyl. And we developed, everybody had songs and rock music playing out of their dorm rooms. I remember when I checked into my dorm room, in 1970, which was my fall of 1970, which was my freshman year in college, practically every dorm room had their windows wide open, stereo speakers in the windows, and almost everybody was playing the music from Woodstock. And you could hear everything coming, a big jumble of sound coming out. And I thought, okay, yeah, I'm where I'm supposed to be. This is cool.
While you were in university, following like rock and roll, another obviously large part of the hippie movement was drugs. Did you partake in many drugs, partying, things like that?
Not really. I, like everyone else, I did smoke dope. I smoked marijuana. I dropped acid once. Did not like that acid trip. I was lying on someone's couch and watching the ceiling fan go around, and the blades of the fan started turning into snakes and were whipping around. And that scared me a little bit. I didn't do anything beyond that. I think I smoked hash a couple of times. But marijuana, hash, and one time of LSD was pretty much it for me. Marijuana, it got me high, but it got me depressed as well. I just kind of sat in the corner by myself and let my pupils get big and spin around a lot. It wasn't an uncomfortable feeling, but it wasn't what other people were describing and saying, oh, it's so relaxing, it's so beautiful, it's so wonderful. It was kind of annoying at times for me.
Did you have a desire to be more involved in this sort of drug culture at the time, like from peer influences? Or was it more just you didn't want to be involved because of personal reasons? And like, which weighed heavier in your taking of drugs? A better way to word it, was the reason you were taking drugs, was it due to curiosity, peer influence?
It was a little bit curiosity, a little bit peer influence. I mean, when you're a freshman in college, you're sitting around your dorm room with your roommate, then across the hall you got two more roommates, and these were male dorms at the time, and a bunch of 18 and 19-year-old kids just sitting around. We would, if anyone had some dope, we'd smoke it because it was our way of bonding and getting to know each other better. We used to go out and get 75-cent bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine, and that was the most god-awful thing you could ever put in your body, but it was 75 cents, and it got you drunk. It was the cheapest drunk ever. And we'd do that, drink some Boone's Farm and smoke some dope. It was not really peer pressure, but just college kid dorm room activity.
Did music at the time have large influence due to a lot of its focus and content being based on drugs?
Not really. I listened to the music because I liked the music, not because of its content. I've never been someone to listen to lyrics as much as I listened to the musicianship, the arrangements, how the vocals blend with each other. That's what I was focused on, was the overall effect, not anything drug related. I hardly listen to lyrics ever. In fact, if you ask me today to list some of my favorite lyrics, I don't think I can.
At the time, were there any other genres of music you listened to other than rock? Like, were there sort of smaller genres that were like more relevant at the time, despite not being as big as rock and roll, that you listened to, or just sort of groups to the side that you listened to?
Oh, yes, of course. Because I played in jazz bands in high school, I listened to a lot of jazz. And then during that time period, jazz was branching out, and with performers like Chick Corea and a group called Weather Report, and Miles Davis was breaking out of his cool period and becoming more and more experimental. They would be hiring some musicians who could play a lot of different kinds of music, a lot of different styles of music. And I listened to it all. In fact, the jazz rock group, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, most of that group were formed by session musicians who would go and play whatever style of music they were getting paid to play. and they formed that group. And sure, they built themselves. They started kind of a new category, jazz rock, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And then Chicago Transit Authority, otherwise known as Chicago, came out, another jazz rock band. These guys were all professional musicians who played for other performers, other singers and pop stars, but they broke out on their own and did their own music.
At the time, did you listen to largely, I'd say, American music, like music coming from American creators, or were you also involved in non-American artists such as David Bowie or the Beatles?
Oh, yeah, Beatles. Beatles, in fact, when I was in the sixth grade, four of us guys got together and we put on these black stocking caps and fluffed them up to make it look like hair. And then we got these old beat-up guitars and a drum set, and we lip-synced to Beatles songs for a school event. But actually what I really enjoyed around that time was Brazilian music, sambas, João Gilberto, Astrud Gilberto. I love that classical guitar, that acoustic guitar, and the samba beat. It was relaxing. It was happy. It was just a different sound that I'd ever heard before.
During this time in your life, which music groups would you say had the most influence on you, or which ones were you most interested in at the time? Like, if you had to pick a handful.
Okay, the first group that comes to mind is Simon and Garfunkel. And earlier I said I didn't pay much attention to lyrics, but with Simon and Garfunkel, just those two voices, and Art Garfunkel's amazing, crystal clear tenor voice, they got me listening to lyrics. And I saw Paul Simon's writing as not just a pop musician, but as a true poet.
Did Simon and Garfunkel have any notable effects on you? Did it change you as a person? Did it change type of music you were interested to? Did it change your thoughts, your feelings, like who you were as a person?
I think so. At the time, I was just kind of muddling through college. My grades weren't all that great. But listening to Simon and Garfunkel, listening to those lyrics and the arrangements that they had when they would go into the studio and have more musicians there in some of their later albums, I started to really think about music as a profession, think about music as a way to reach out to people, and not just for my own pleasure, but as a way to affect other people. That was when I seriously considered, hey, I could probably do this.
You mentioned that before college you had partaken in a couple of bands with you and your brother. Did you ever have any motivation to go farther than just that? Did you ever have any desire to want to be one of the big names out there? Like, did you want to play in a big band that would tour across the US or anything like that? Or were you just doing it to have fun, stay small?
I was doing it to have fun. My brother had other ideas. My brother, this was something that he really wanted to do. In fact, when he bought his drum set, our mother said, "No way, no how are you going to have drums in this house? Too much racket." So he saved up a bunch of money. He bought a old drum set from his drum teacher, and he kept it at the music store where he had his lessons. And then when my mother went back to work full time, he snuck his drums home and put it in his room, and tried to keep it from Mom for a while. He was in the eighth grade at the time. Of course, she found out about it, but he persisted, and she relented and let him keep his drums and play.
When was it that you came out of this sort of rock and roll hippie era sort of phase, like, and moved on to other types of music? Because after studying music at OU, you started playing in orchestras, correct?
Yes. When I switched to the double bass and started playing in the University of Oklahoma Orchestra, my whole musical being switched over to classical music. I would literally spend 4 to 6 hours a night in the practice room because I was starting so late on the bass. I had to catch up. And so I was immersed in classical music of all periods. I played recorders in a Collegium Musicum, which was a group that played music from medieval and Renaissance and early Baroque periods. I played trombone in a trombone choir, and music for choirs of trombones are two different periods. In the Middle Ages and Renaissance period, and in the 20th century. And there is really nothing written for choirs of trombones between those two periods. And that was a lot of fun. The music was sometimes very difficult. We were challenged all the time to play. One of my favorite concerts that we did was the great American composer Aaron Copland came and stayed at OU for a week. The composition teacher at OU was a student of his at one point, and so he was invited and he came and he conducted us in a concert of his music. And he was just the sweetest, most lovely man I'd ever met in my life. And he even took suggestions from the orchestra. One of the percussion players said, "Excuse me, maestro, in this section here, you have written this way," and he played it on the snare drum. And "But I think it would sound better this way," and he played it his way. And Mr. Copland said, "You know what? You're right. Write it in." And it was just incredible. The focus and the intensity that you have to play classical music.
Okay, we're going to stop this part of the interview here because there's a 45-minute limit with this app. We're going to continue it with a part two after this, so yeah.
Let me go grab something to drink.
Mm-hmm.